question about how we're educating young people about drugs. This is Asha Bandele. I direct the grants program here at the Drug Policy Alliance, which is the nation's leading organization dedicated to ensuring that both the harms of drug use and the harms of the drug war are reduced to the maximum extent possible and in a way that's consistent with public safety and health. This town hall we're having today is part of an ongoing series of public discussions we've been having to not only provide evidence-based information about drugs and drug laws in our society, but also to ensure that we're hearing from you who are impacted by both. A couple of notes, please, about format and logistics. I'm going to make a few framing remarks today and then introduce our speaker who will talk with me for roughly 25 minutes. Immediately following that, I'm going to open up the line so we can hear from all of you, not all at once, of course, and answer as many of your questions for Dr. Hart as possible. Do be mindful that we have literally hundreds of people gathered here today. So please, 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 I know this is hard. Do strive to ask a one-line question or as close to a one-line question as possible and capture any comments you might have as much as you possibly can. That's so we can get as many voices in the room, as it were, today. Your lines are right now muted, so when we begin the Q&A portion of the call, if you have a question or a comment, you will need to press 5 on your keypad. That'll signal to me that your hand is raised. Do not press 5 on your Twitter feed. I will not see that. It's got to be on your keypad. We'll be keeping a queue, and we're going to open up lines in order of the questions received. And for those of you who are going to be tweeting during the talk, please use the hashtag #RealDrugTalk. So with that said, let me begin here and just offer that for a decade I've entered these sorts of conversations as specifically someone who's deeply invested in helping to provide resources to our growing movement of reformers, whether it's financial or intellectual. And I do wear that hat today, surely, but I want to say that I also sit here, as our guest does, as the parent of a teenager, the parent of a human being who is likely most at risk when it comes to the potential harms born of both drug use and drug policy. When I thought about that, coupled with the reality that there's probably no question that seems to sort of stymie our push to have drugs regulated and controlled, then this inquiry, what about the kids? What about the children? I knew that there was no one better to unpack that, the answer to that query, than neuroscientist, Columbia University professor, Dr. Carl Hart, who's not only the nation's leading expert on drugs of abuse, a man who has advised presidents on at least 2 continents and given TED Talks, written for and been covered regularly by the New York Times. He's not only the author of the award-winning and best-selling memoir, High Price, A Neuroscientist's Journey of Self-Discovery that challenges everything you know about drugs in society, as well as the co-author of the nation's leading college text on the subject entitled Drugs, Society, and Human Behavior. But Carl is the father of 3 sons, one who's a rising sophomore and one who's about to enter high school. For all of those reasons, I wanted to talk to him, and I wanted to talk to him before you. And even with that intro, I feel compelled to say that if Dr. Hart is introducing himself, he'd just say he's a man from around the way, a boy from a hood who became an advocate for science and justice. And so as we're relaxing, as we're a nation sort of relaxing some of our laws about drugs, and as we're also, I'm aware, smack in the midst of prom and party season, as we enter the less structured hot months of summer, we just knew it was important to right now consider not just what we should be thinking about, but how we should be thinking about our children and drug laws, which is why we turn to my friend, my colleague, Dr. Carl Hart. Good afternoon, Carl.
Good afternoon, Asha. It's great to talk to you. You know, the lovely introduction is far too long, but thank you. and I'd like to also say hello to all the brothers and sisters and friends who around the country who are listening in. And I also recognize that we will have some enemies. I'd be remiss without saying hello to them as well.
I appreciate that Malcolm X inspired introduction as we near his birthday, the anniversary of his birth. And that aside, I mean, let's begin at the beginning, where the question is most urgent for parents and caretakers, which is in a world in which it seems that drugs are ever more available and where we hear reports of the increased potency of illicit drugs. What do you say when asked the question, how do we keep our children safe?
Well, that question that you just asked, there's a number of sort of questions embedded in that question. I mean, you know, there's an assumption. The one assumption is that drugs have become more potent. And so when we talk about drugs have become more potent, we're really talking about marijuana, where we have seen increasing levels of THC, the main psychoactive compound, and marijuana that has been confiscated off of the streets. There has been a slight increase in the average THC concentration. Some people have argued that this will make the marijuana that kids are smoking today different from the marijuana that their parents smoking, and different being more dangerous and should cause us more concern. That's a nice example of how we take a little information and then we distort it. And we distort it to the point where we are wrong and hyperbolic. So let me give you an example. It is true that people have become more sophisticated in their ability to grow marijuana with higher THC concentrations, particularly as we have the internet, we have all of these ways of communicating how to do it. But historically, we have always known how to breed marijuana with high THC concentration. So that portion is not new. There have always been people who have smoked really good marijuana, while there have been those other folks who have smoked, as they call it, just whack weed or garbage weed. Now, what does that mean in terms of keeping children safe? Think about it this way. We have some alcohol. We have, I think, Bacardi 151. So you can get rum that is 151% proof. Whereas you can also go to the store and buy a Budweiser, which contains a small amount of alcohol. No one is talking about how this is now some new alcohol that is posing more danger to your children. It's just that people drink the alcohol that is 151 or stronger, or a stronger alcoholic beverage, they would drink differently than they would drink a beer. It's kind of simple. One of the advantages of smoking a drug is that you detect the psychoactive effects a lot more rapidly and a lot more readily. So when people understand that they have a stronger, potent cigarette, you don't smoke it in the same way you would smoke whack weed or a weaker cigarette. That's just common sense, and that's what humans have been doing since humans have been smoking marijuana. So it's an exaggeration when people tell you that the marijuana that your children are smoking is not the same marijuana that your parents smoked or their parents smoked. It's an exaggeration, and it doesn't do any good when, in fact, we miss an opportunity to help educate kids and say, please understand something about the strength of the marijuana that you're smoking. If you are a novice in terms of smoking marijuana, do not start smoking like a champion. You have to crawl before you walk. Start with lower doses. Take smaller puffs. Don't inhale like you are an expert. That's stupid. And people who do that probably won't be around to tell us about it. That's just not very smart. But we missed the opportunity to educate our kids about these simple, basic facts.
Do you think that, I mean, you know, this isn't actually the question I'm going to ask next, but, I mean, I can just imagine the parents who says, well, if I tell them, you know, learn how to smoke as though you're a novice, that would be tantamount to telling them to smoke. themselves or get high, whether it's marijuana or another substance. How would you respond to that, Carl?
I'm sorry, can you say that again? I didn't hear you as well.
Oh, sure. So I would imagine that a parent hearing that advice right now would hear you say, well, don't smoke like you're a champ, use it like you're a novice. A parent might worry, well, is that encouraging my child to use drugs?
Yeah, that's always a concern when people are giving common sense advice. That certainly has been one of the arguments against giving common sense advice. Think about it this way. There are about half of the adults in the United States have tried marijuana at some point in their life. In fact, the last three presidents all smoked marijuana as young people. So there is a 50% probability that your child will smoke marijuana. Your children will do some things that you may not want them to do. That's just part of life, and that's part of parenting. The key becomes, do you give them information to help them stay safe and live another day? Even though it may not be the behavior in which you like them to engage. And so as a parent and as a scientist and as an educator, it's always better to provide education that will help keep people safe, even if I don't want them to engage in the behavior. So this notion that giving solid information that keeps children safe somehow condones the behavior, that's just simply stupid. And we haven't called it out as a public with a clear voice. We allow that sort of thing to interject into these conversations like it's rational or reasonable. It's just it's not very smart.
And potentially dangerous. And let me shift a little bit and move to some things that not only I've sort of read in your really beautiful memoir, also sort of Big Science Book, High Price, but also things I've heard you say in various talks. And that's that, you know, you're less concerned with your son's potential engagement with drugs, and you know, you left that sort of open-ended, drugs in general, than you are their engagement with police. Are you being hyperbolic when you make statements like that? And if you're not, would you unpack the meaning behind that statement, please?
I have said that in the book, and I also say that in my writings. I think that I would much rather have my children interact with drugs than the police. And this should not be. This should be less controversial today, given what we have seen across the country in places like Baltimore, Charleston, Ferguson, Trayvon Martin, here in the Bronx with Marley Graham. That's not a controversial statement. At one point, it used to be, particularly with some white parents. They were, I think they thought it was more hyperbolic. The actual point behind that statement is this. As a scientist who studies drugs, I have given thousands of doses of drugs like marijuana, cocaine, crack cocaine, methamphetamine, thousands of doses of these drugs to people and carefully studied their effects as a result of the generosity of your tax dollars. And I do this as part of my research. And one of the most important lessons I've learned throughout my studies is that drug effects are predictable. That is, if you know something about a few variables, like the dose that was taken, the experience of the user, the conditions under which the drug was taken, where the drug was taken, and the route of administration, how the drug was used, you can predict these drug effects. You can predict them such that you're more likely to enhance the positive effects of the drugs and minimize the negative effects of the drugs. That's not difficult to do. Drug effects are not unpredictable as we were told in the 1980s. if you understand these few variables. Given that I understand those variables quite well, that means that I can teach my children some lessons about drugs, the drugs that they're more likely to use. And in these cases, we're talking about alcohol, marijuana, and tobacco. Those are the drugs that the adolescents are more likely to use. The other drug use by adolescents is really low. And so when you think about that fact, the fact that these drug effects are predictable, and I know how to keep my children safe with drugs, and I don't know how to keep my children safe with the police, because particularly black folks' interactions with police are not predictable. And when you have this sort of unpredictability versus predictability, that's not a controversial statement. That's a smart statement. I would be remiss as a parent if I don't make these comments and make this understood to my children. Then I think I would need to be reprimanded as a parent for not doing a good job in raising these black boys that I have. And so it's not controversial, it's honest, and it's smart. And I'm trying to make sure that my kids do well in this society by making a contribution to the society.
And so talk about that. You have a teenager and a 20-year-old. What are the conversations about drugs like in your home? And maybe let me take that a little bit further and ask how aligned they are with the general way young people are taught about drugs in school and vis-a-vis other institutions like recovery clinics and media campaigns.
Most of the stuff that's raised as drug education in this country should be criminal. I mean, most of it is just rubbish, and it has no foundations in evidence or anything we know about drugs. Now, what I do with my children, again, I talked about these few variables that are important in terms of predicting drug effects and understanding drug effects. So I make sure my kids, first of all, they understand that the major risk of them with drugs is being arrested, of being having interactions with police as a result of drug use. So that's the thing we harp on in my household. Don't use drugs in situations or in places where you're more likely to be caught by the police. But much prefer you use drugs in my home or near me so I can protect you. But the most dangerous concern is with the police. That's number one. Number two, I worry about the dose at which they are using. If they are inexperienced, do not use large doses of drugs. One has to become tolerant to many of the effects of drugs, and that tolerance protects people. It protects folks from the harmful effects that may occur related to drugs. That's number one. So start with lower doses. Number two, make sure that you actually know something about the drug effects that you are taking, that you're going to engage in. So if you're going to smoke marijuana, for example, one of the things that's very likely to happen to inexperienced marijuana users is that you might become a bit anxious or a little paranoid. The thing is that don't worry, it will wear off. Just chill, it'll wear off. Many people get in trouble from this over-concern about the anxiety and the paranoia, and then they may do something stupid. So understand something about the positive effects as well as the potential negative effects of the drug use that you're in which you're engaging. That's number two. Number three, make sure that wherever you're using drugs, that you're using it in a comfortable environment, in a safe environment, in an environment that is less likely to contribute to anxiety-provoking effects. Because there can be this interaction with environment and drug effects that enhances the likelihood of paranoia and anxiety and those sorts of things. Number four, make sure you understand something about route of administration, how the drug is used. If you're smoking marijuana versus eating it. If you're smoking marijuana, the onset of the effects will occur within 5 minutes or so, 10 minutes or so. You feel the effect. Whereas if you're eating it with an edible or something, you may not feel the effects for 60 or 90 minutes after you have taken the drug. So that means don't continue to put loads of the edible in your gut. If you do, then you increase the likelihood of having an awful experience. You increase the likelihood of getting really paranoid. You may increase the likelihood of thinking that you're going to die. And so they have to know something about route of administration, onset of drug effects. These are the kinds of things that we talk about in my household in terms of drugs. But I should tell you, the drug conversation in my household is that takes a considerable backseat. The most important conversation in my household with my children is that their job is to make a contribution to this society. And one way you make a contribution to society as a young person is that you do really well in school so you can have that opportunity. And anything that disrupts their doing well in school, whether it's playing video games too much, whether it's hanging out with a significant other too much, whatever, whether it's using a drug, whatever it is, I am watching for that behavior. I'm watching for the disruption of their school performance. That's the behavior I'm watching for. And if I see disruption in school performance, now my child and I have a problem. So I'm not looking specifically for a drug use. I'm looking for my kids to perform like I expect them to perform. So performance is the number one thing that parents should be looking at. They should be looking at how their child is performing, not their brain, not whether they're looking at a job. I mean, not whether they're looking at for a drug, but they should be looking at how well the kid is performing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's active parenting. Let me just make a note to our listening audience. I have one or two more questions here, and then we're going to open up the lines. I do want to note that all of you who raised your hand immediately after I said the keypad remark, we've taken your hands down just because it's really hard to manage from our end. I'm going to prompt you when it is time to raise your hands so we can have this open dialogue with you. And with that said, let me stay here sort of in this area, especially because across the nation we're seeing significant shifts in marijuana laws, ranging from outright legalization to ever more popular decriminalization. And likely the argument against the liberalization of these laws is that gets the most traction in the media is the impact of marijuana specifically, but other drugs more generally, including alcohol, have on the developing adolescent brain. So, you know, I ask you both as a parent, and certainly a neuroscientist, really specifically here, because I haven't heard anyone speak as clearly to that, especially when they're talking about kids and drugs. What are parents and other caretakers to make of the impact of drugs on the developing adolescent brain, and where does the science and the general reporting meet and provide us an unbiased dose of truth?
Yeah, the impact of drugs on the developing brains, as been talked about in much of drug abuse science, has been, we've actually done such a disservice to the public in that regard. So then, so I have to unpack this, so I'll take a step back. Now, one of the things that we know in science, it relates to the point of a little bit of knowledge can be dangerous. One of the things that we know in science is that the prefrontal cortex is one of the last sort of structures in the brain to develop. Now, it develops late in adolescence, early 20s or so. Some less than bright people have taken that information and said that when you smoke marijuana or use some drug, you will disrupt or you run the risk of ruining that sort of development. Now, the prefrontal cortex is critically important for functions like planning, decision-making, all of these sort of complicated functions that humans accomplish. It's an important region. And so people will say, well, you run the risk of disrupting those important functions. Now, it is true if you have some sort of real trauma to your prefrontal cortex that you can possibly do some real harmful, some real damage, and we all should be concerned. But now, let's take a step back. Another thing that we know about neurobiology and the brain and development is this. Children's brains are a lot more plastic than adults' brains. So that is, if you have some brain damage as a child, you might actually have these compensatory brain mechanisms that allow you to function later in life like you had no damage at all. Whereas if that damage occurs as an adult, you will see some devastating behavioral deficits as a result. Let me just give you one example that will help clarify.
Let me jump in there just for a second, just to pull that apart. So should we think of it almost in the way, and I don't know if I'm right here, if a child breaks their arm, I remember seeing a kid with a broken arm, and I had a similar break. It took me 3 months to heal or something like that, and that kid was in a cast for 3 weeks, he told me. Is it the same sort of concept as that?
Certainly, you can use that concept. You certainly can use it. The bottom line is that as children, the brain is more plastic and more likely to actually bounce back. So let me give you one dramatic example. There's this thing called hemispheric rectomy, where we remove one half of your brain, half of your hemisphere, in some children, because they have epileptic seizures that are so bad that it's causing so many problems. In order to treat this, in some cases, we remove half of the brain, one half of the hemisphere. Now, those children develop in life. They go on and have a productive life, and you can see some deficits, but not many. Now, if you do the same thing in an adult, that would be devastating. You wouldn't recognize that person as having function. So right. That just goes to show how plastic the developing brain really is. That's one point. And another point, as we think about the prefrontal cortex, which is unlike the top of the brain, what we usually see in these higher functions, the top of the brain, the cortical regions of the brain we call cortical, that is a lot more plastic and flexible than the subcortical regions. So if you experience trauma on the sort of cortical portions of the brain, that's what we're talking about, the prefrontal cortex, a lot more plastic than subcortical regions. When I say subcortical regions, I mean things like the limbic system, which is important for emotion, the thalamus, which is important for like a relay system or station in the brain, the hypothalamus, all of those are subcortical. Those are a lot less plastic. So when people talk about the impact of drugs on the developing brain, oftentimes they really don't know neurobiology. They just use a little bit of information and scare the public. Now, I want to make this point absolutely clear. No one is encouraging young people to go out and use drugs. That's a given. I just want to make sure everybody understands that. I don't want anybody to misinterpret or twist my words. I would discourage young people from using illicit drugs, just like I would from using alcohol or those sorts of things as well. So that's number one. But the point is, my major point here is that little bit of information about brain development, the prefrontal cortex, has been so distorted that it means almost nothing, and that it is unnecessarily frightening parents, and it annoys me.
So as I move to open up the lines, and now for those of you who have questions, please do press 5 on your keypad. Let me ask you finally, Carl, to do this with me. We're both black parents. I want you to turn to please the black parents who are on the phone today, and so many of us, drawing on the media hysteria that elevated the role of drugs like crack played in the destruction of our communities, not drugs like crack, while underreporting the impact of what the loss of social safety nets played. So many of us supported laws that contributed to mass incarceration and mass criminalization, as well as contributed to the language that really stigmatized a sector of our population that would otherwise be known, for so many of us who consider ourselves Christian, as the least of these. The poorest, often the most traumatized, the most in need often of mental health services, they were discarded, and often by us. What would you say to us about what we need to do right now, to now that we know better? What do we do better?
Well, I don't know if many of us know better, because I still walk down the streets, and I still hang out in places and hear people making incredibly ignorant statements about drugs. So I think a number of people are still being misled about the harms and the dangers of drugs. And so for those people, I just hope they read things like High Price. I hope they check out my website, at drcarlhart.com. I hope they get some better education. And then for those who now know better, you know, it's not a crime to make a mistake. In fact, it's human, and we make mistakes because in order for us to learn. So we own our mistakes. I certainly make mistakes. We own our mistakes, and then we try and get better. So those people who were complicit in passing those awful laws, and they were out there saying misunderstanding what were the real problems in the communities, those people who were doing that, it's okay to have made mistakes. Just own it and say, now I have new information, better information, and I'm going to try my best to make it right. And so I certainly don't want to beat up on people who made mistakes. In fact, I actually want to hang out with people who made mistakes, and they own their mistakes, because me too.
Well, with that beautiful offering, let me go to our many, many, many phone lines. I will remind you, please make your questions one line. We have 27 minutes left in the call, and I can't even count the number of hands that are up. With that said, let me begin with Stanton Peel. We're going to bring up your line now, and your line is now open. Dr. Peel?
Hi, Dr. Carl. Peel, hi, Asha. Hi, Carl. Can you hear me?
Brother Stanton.
Hi, Brother Carl. Carl, one of the most fascinating things that you talk about for me is the fact that some of the drugs that we fear the most, like meth, have a close chemical resemblance to drugs that we readily give to children, like Adderall. So it seems that we're almost playing both sides of the fence. You say that as a way of making us more aware of meth, putting it into life-size proportions, but at the same time that you speak about the unadvisability of kids taking drugs, we're feeding kids drugs that have relatively the same chemical effects. How do you react to that kind of thing?
Yeah, so as you point out, we and other people have done studies where we've compared the active ingredient in Adderall, amphetamine, to methamphetamine under double-blind conditions, and you see that they're essentially the same drug. And so how do I respond to the fact that kids are being prescribed essentially methamphetamine? As is the case with any sort of medical condition, one has to weigh the risk-benefit ratio. That is, are the benefits from giving a drug like methamphetamine to children do those benefits outweigh the disruptive effect of the child's disorder? If so, if the risk-benefit ratio is favorable, I'm all for that child being administered that drug to help control their symptoms. I'm all for that on the one hand. I am also all for our military pilots who are also taking essentially methamphetamine in order to accomplish their jobs, particularly those who work extended hours. I am also for professors who are writing novels and books and so forth if they are using amphetamines to help them do their job better. That's the beautiful thing about pharmacology. When done right, you can use pharmacology to enhance human function. And so I think that in part what I'm trying to do is to help people understand how to enhance the positive effects of these pharmacological tools while minimizing the negative effects.
Thank you so much, Carl. Let me turn to Jamila Lemieux. Jamila, your line is now live.
Hi, Asha. Hi, Carl. Considering how much I'm well, how are you? Thank you both so much for such a rich conversation. Considering how much information has been made available to us over the course of many years, and in particular in recent years, with so much of the fantastic work that you've done, Carl, there still is, as you mentioned earlier, this cultural attitude around marijuana in the African American community that finds a lot of parents and grandparents that are extremely judgmental and fearful of what marijuana usage looks like for their children, even if it's something that they were able to successfully use in the past themselves. What do you think it's ultimately going to take to have a cultural paradigm shift for Black people to lose the attitude that being a pot smoker means that you are lazy, shiftless, that you're not doing the sort of things you need to do? And for us to acknowledge publicly how many of the doctors, lawyers, teachers, professors, journalists, politicians that we look up to are regular, if not avid, marijuana smokers.
That's a great question. In every talk I give, I try and make sure I point out that Brother Barack Obama, you know, smoked marijuana, and Clinton admitted to smoking, but begrudgingly, and then he said that he did not inhale. And then when Barack Obama was asked about it, Barack Obama said they asked him if he inhaled, and he said that was the point. And so one of the things I try to do is make it clear to people that these people who we respect smoke marijuana, and I certainly smoke marijuana. It's not my favorite drug. I think there are better drugs. But the point is that I try and show people who are successful, paying their taxes, taking care of their families, making a contribution to this society. I try and make sure that I ask people to come out of the closet. I mean, that's how we change things, if those respected people in our society come out of the closet about their drug use. Because if people only see this limited view of folks who use drugs, and those people that they see are folks in our society who are not respected and who are screwing up, and they think that those are the drug users, that's not good. But there's another thing at operation here, and particularly in the Black community, as you know, this issue of the politics of respectability. One of the politics of respectability, for those who don't know, basically is that we want to show that we are good and that we are deserving for white folks. And so drug use is one of those tools by which people separate the good Negroes from the bad Negroes. And so we have to get rid of that sort of politics of using drugs in our sort of politics of respectability. And so we need people who are respectable, I hate that term, but people who are doing well in society, who are responsible, to come out of the closet and say, me too.
Yeah, I appreciate that. We're going to bring Elizabeth Gaines' line live, and right thereafter, just so you can be prepared as you're listening, after that, Scott Cecil. So Elizabeth Gaines and then Scott Cecil. Elizabeth, your line is live. Is that Liz Gaines?
Yes. Can you hear me okay?
You can, Liz. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Dr. Hart, I love you. I've bought many copies of your books and given them all to my representatives so they can get educated, because the big issue is the fact that everybody lives when they were kids and think, marijuana, ha, ha, ha. Oh, that's funny. It's really a useful drug. I guess that doesn't have to do with kids, but I don't know how to get over that, that it's a serious thing that addresses multiple sclerosis, which is what I have, and is very effective to treat it. How to get over that garbage about thinking that it's just silly. And I also, I want to tell you, I also come out and try and be really honest that I do this, even though it's not really legal in my state yet, because I think that's part of showing that respectable people smoke. I have a degree from an Ivy League institution. I've worked for 30 years in a job I love. I'm respectable. I smoke, and I need to smoke. But overcoming the giggling about it, it's an effective drug, is my problem.
Yeah, I mean, and so you also, so you have a number of people like Montel Williams who've been coming out on these sorts of things. And when people joke and laugh about those sorts of things, you have to make sure that you sufficiently punish them for behaving like children. And you have to call people out. There are a number of these comedy shows. Many of these guys I really love. They do really good comedy. But then when it comes to drugs, they revert to adolescence, and they treat it like they are adolescents. People who we like, the liberal or whatever you call these folks, they are part of the problem too, because they treat drugs as if it's an immature adolescent subject, or they become immature and adolescent when it comes to the drug conversations, and we must hold them accountable even though we like them.
Appreciate that. We're going to bring Scott Cecil's line live, and Scott is from SSDP, I believe. It's nice to have somebody in the age range we're talking about joining us for the call. Scott, your line is live.
Yeah, thanks so much for taking my question. Scott Cecil and Jake Agliano from SSDP, and we have a couple of students in the room here with us as well. I just want to revisit an earlier question. Someone asked Dr. Hart about decriminalization versus legalization. And in light of the fact that street-level drug dealers do not card and criminal cartels don't pay taxes, isn't legalization the superior solution to decriminalization, both in terms of public policy, but also in terms of keeping drugs out of the hands of young adults and children?
Yeah, I don't know if anybody asked me that question here today. You must be talking about another time, but that's a good question anyway. When you think about the difference between decriminalization and legalization, just for people who don't know, decriminalization would be treating drugs just like we treat traffic violations. People don't go to jail, but they might receive a fine for possession. Whereas legalization, we treat it just like alcohol, and like we do marijuana out in Colorado, Alaska, Washington, and Oregon. So, I think, you know, when we think about the difference between the two, in High Price, I argue that we should decriminalize all drugs in a way that they've done in Portugal and the Czech Republic, because they are doing well. They're doing better than us on all of those indicators. But then over the past year or two, I have I've been thinking and I have been learning. And now I am more in favor of legal regulation of drugs, not because of the cartels and those sorts of things that you said. In fact, I really don't like those kind of discussions, because in any society, you're going to have people who will engage in deviant behaviors and underground economies and so forth. As long as you have disparities, you're going to always have that. So I'm not saying legalize or regulate the drug market so we get rid of the drug dealers. They'll just find something else to do. That's what smart people do. I'm more in favor of drug regulation, legal drug regulation, because of this fact. The drugs themselves pose less of a danger to our children and our society than do the adulterants that people cut drugs with. So the adulterants, for example, cocaine is cut largely these days with something called levamisole. Levamisole is an animal dewormer, and it decreases white blood cells, rendering us less able to deal with infections, and in some cases it could be deadly. And other drugs are cut with other things that are not so pleasant. Now, decriminalization doesn't touch that sort of aspect of the illicit drug market. So that's why I'm in favor of regulating the illegal drug market so we can get better quality control. So people will know what they're getting, what doses they're getting, and it decreases the likelihood of them being harmed by some adulterant when they simply just wanted to get high and not die.
Thanks so much, Carl. We're going to turn to Barbara Kirkland Dennis, and right after Barbara, we'll go to Sarah Arnold. Barbara, your line is now live.
Oh, thank you. I can't believe I was chosen. However, I'm going to make it as brief as possible. I just want to say I have a lifelong or personal and professional experience. I'm 73 years old, and I've been advocating. I don't believe I'm hearing what I heard of, and I'm in awe, and that's why I just, it's only so much I can say right now, but I will be in touch. Mothers of Those in Crisis is my organization. For 37 years I've been doing this as a volunteer. I've got a personal and professional, like I said, I've got a couple of degrees in substance abuse and all of those things. So I'm going to be in touch with both of you by email and everything else, and I hope to be coming up to New York real soon. I need some time with both of you. Thank you. Thank you so much for allowing me this. Be blessed. Stay strong. And we're on our way. Oh, it's good. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Ms. Kirkland. Dennis, thank you so much. We're going to turn to Sarah Arnold.
Hi. Hi, Asha. Hi, Carl. I'll be quick.
Sarah.
Hi. Thank you for doing this, guys. It's great to say that we should give our kids drug education, which is harm reduction based, including them doing it at home so we can keep our eyes on them, and I agree, my parents did that for me. I want to do that for my kids. But what about the risks from Child Protective Services overuse by our children at home, and you know, where we can keep our eye on them, or our own parental drug use?
Protective Child Services. You know, that's the toughest nut, in part because you have a number of legal players, judges, and so forth in the family court who drug education has completely missed family court. And I testify quite a bit in family court. And I don't know. That's one of the ones that stops me more than anything. Because not everyone has an equal potential to be in family court. The least among us are the ones who are in family court. And so the best available information is not always required when it comes to drugs. There's so much misinformation about what drugs does to the developing fetus, for example. What does prenatal drug exposure do? In family court, there are a number of players who still believe in the crack baby phenomena, even though all of the evidence shows that that was the epidemic that was not. Everyone knows that now, except family court. And now family court in many places are removing children from parents because parents test positive. Some women test positive during pregnancy or later for marijuana, and these children are being removed. I don't know how to really crack that nut besides the constant public writing about it in op-eds and embarrassing and exposing what's going on in family court, because family court is closed. It's so closed that much of the public doesn't know the horrible things that are happening in family court. And so I think we really need to write about it and expose it. And I do my best, but we need more than me exposing the family court, the things that are going on in family court.
Thank you. That was really a really good, thorough answer, especially for somebody who's not an attorney. I appreciate that and appreciate the question, Sarah. We're going to turn to Russ Belville and then Jacqueline Patterson in this remaining 10 minutes. I'll try to get a couple more questions in if possible. Russ, your line is now open.
Thank you. Russ Belville from 420 Radio. Dr. Hart, you do a fantastic job of debunking some of the myths proposed by prohibitionists and anti-drug crusaders. What are some of the myths on our side, the drug reform side, that we maybe ought to put into check?
Thank you for that question. That's a great question. So when you say drug reformers, some of the myths that we... what are the things that drug reformers, they get seduced by politicians and people who... co-opt our language. For example, the current administration, when they came in, they said something like, we won't be having a war on drugs anymore. We're getting rid of that language. And then people thought that they were progressive because of that sort of thing. And of course, they really haven't been progressive on this issue. And then we relax on people who we vote for, and we don't hold their feet to the fire like we should. When we, for example, in 2010, President Obama signed into legislation, into law, the change between the crack powder laws. Crack cocaine was punished 100 times more harshly than powder cocaine before 2010 when he signed the legislation. The legislation decreased the disparity from 100 to 1 to 18 to 1. That's equally bad, and that's equally inconsistent with the science. It should be one-to-one. But as a result of that signing, we, the progressives, kind of let the issue go, and we didn't put more pressure on it. That's equally bad. As we think about now, we are liberalizing marijuana laws around the country, and people are feeling themselves, slapping themselves on the back. And at the same time, we are punishing opiate and heroin violations more harshly than we ever have. And we are falling for, they say, as they say in the hood, we're falling for the okey-doke in believing that we have this sort of heroin epidemic. But when you start to actually look at the numbers and you start to see where the real problems are, You start to see that this is the same type of hysteria that happened in the 80s around crack cocaine. And so as we are excited about marijuana, we forget about the rest of these things. And so I think that the drug reformers need to be hypervigilant and not be fooled by people co-opting language that sounds good. Now, I understand that when you've been oppressed so long, when someone, you know, and you've been oppressed so long and so thirsty for so long, and someone comes along and gives you a sip of water, you think that they are, the savior. But in that water, they may have cyanide in that water, so you have to be careful.
Wow. we're sitting around here. We mute the calls while you're giving your answer, sitting here in the conference room. And so that response got a very strong reaction in this room. We appreciate it. We are going to go to Jacqueline Patterson. Next, Jacqueline, your line is open.
Hello. Actually, I'm standing in for Jacqueline. She actually had to go to school with her son, and he answered not necessarily answered it, but sufficiently gave information about it. I just wanted to commend him about his ideals about his children. I don't know if he was actually saying it like this, but that his children have to earn a place in society not necessarily earn, but, you know, gain that respect to be an acceptable person, providing to the society. Should I say, But as to that, I leave my rest of my time. I'm sorry, I waste yours.
No, thank you very much. We'll just keep moving. Claudia Segallo is next. Claudia, excuse me.
Hi.
Thank
you so much for taking my question, my last question. I'm wondering if you have any ideas about how to approach school districts around providing better drug education for children. I have two kids, and they're consistently running Red Ribbon Week and having to sign pledges about not using drug in their lives and, you know, consistently preaching to me about not using drugs. How can we approach school districts to begin to have more effective drug education?
It's an interesting question because my kid goes to one of these elite expensive schools in New York, and they don't, my kid is always having to correct the person who's given drug education, and they have yet to invite me to give drug education there. It's a difficult question. If you're wealthy and you have some influence at the school, you might have a better end. But if you are just a regular parent, I don't know. I think the best thing to do is get the more influential parents behind you and meet with the administration. But if you don't have the influential parents behind you, you can forget it. I don't know. At least I don't know how to do it.
Yeah, you know, thank you, Carl. That is one way to do it. Certainly, if you're in an independent institution, that parents who have the most influence in the school are the ones to lobby first, and then you have to be very active on your child's parent-teacher group. And if it's in a public institution where it's much harder to make change, you can still be very active, especially now some of the charter schools and some of even the public schools have somewhat of an independent focus, but it's really about being exceptionally active, and it harks back to what you were saying before, Carl, about where we begin the conversations, right? And so it's not, you know, it's just having, being a really active parent and sort of disrupting them and also asking to take your kid out of some of the programs at times and not participating, and this is why, and not doing it in a hostile or defensive way, but in a way that's explanatory, and using every moment that you can to put in information into the dialogue that makes sense and that's based in evidence.
Well, be careful. Please be careful with the terminology based on evidence and science, because the scientists have contributed to a lot of this misinformation. So, it's like, be careful with that. That phrase has almost become to mean nothing.
I appreciate that. Thank you so much. And we're going to give the last question, our remaining 3 minutes, to Dan Lynn, who I would ask to capsule as much as possible your question or comment. Dan, your line is live.
Well, thank you. It'll be real quick. I know when we talk about predictable substances or coming out of the closet, how would you suggest talking to teenagers or young adults about psychedelic drug use?
How would I talk about young people about psychedelic drug use? So the thing is that psychedelic drug use is very low in terms of young people. And so I would talk to them about psychedelic drug use in the same way if you suspect or if they're curious about those sorts of things. You really want to make sure that they start off with extremely low doses. The most potent drug that we're kind of talking about is LSD. Just a small amount of that will produce a change or an effect. So sometimes people overestimate the amount that's needed. So they really need to understand that. Start off with low doses, very low doses of psychedelics, and make sure that they're in a comfortable setting with someone who actually knows what they're doing, and not alone and not with novice, because that will increase the likelihood of them panicking and having a bad trip, a bad experience. And so it's really critical that folks are doing these things with people who know what they're doing.
Thank you so much for that. And with that, you know, we're going to come to a conclusion. I apologize for all the folks who are here with their hands in the air. If you think that we need a part two of this discussion, let me ask that you email me at abandele, A-B-A-N-D-E-L-E, at drugpolicy.org. If you'd like a part two of this discussion about our children and drugs, we can certainly coordinate that. The good professor's schedule willing. Just email me again, abandele, A-B-A-N-D-E-L-E, at drugpolicy.org. And Carl, if you would say the title of your website, and so people can go and visit your website and see your books, your articles. There's drcarlhart.com.
Yes, is drcarlhart.com, drcarlhart.com.
Thank you so much. And on that website, you can not only find links to Carl.